Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
G.I. Joe, the very best, America's elite. Eliter than all the rest, trained to have no flaws. Defending liberty across the land, valor oversized. Bring out that big brass band, real heroes verified.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them all, you must agree. Elitist in history,
G.I. Joe.
Oh, there could be no end in a world we must defend.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them. A courageous crew, their colors red, whites, and blue. Mess with them and they'll shoot you. G.I. Joe, gotta read them all. Gotta read them all.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the best and longest running dedicated G.I. Joe comics podcast, my brother says. If you're new to the show, you can find all of the details about us and what we do over at talkingjoe.co.uk. That is the website, talkingjoe.co.uk. It's got the links to everything. Today, we are continuing our look at the Disavowed Era with G.I. Joe America's Elite 25 Cent Special, The Hunt for Cobra Commander, which came out in May 2006. For those reading along in trades, this was collected in the 2007 America's Elite trade paperback number 3, which collects issue 13 to 18. It's probably in the IDW one as well, but I can't see it in the details. So that's up to you to find out. Now, without further ado, joining me to talk about this issue in a mini episode, Tim, mini episode, it's A Real American Tim. It's Tim Finn.
I'm just going to talk really fast for this episode. Hi, listeners. Hi, Mark.
Tim, who are the creators that brought us this issue?
Doing my best, Mark. Impression. Mike O'Sullivan, writer, editor. Josh Medors, penciler. Lee Bo Underwood, inker. Greg Nervaso, colorist. Brian Crowley, letterer, with Datadesk profiles written by Sam Wells, Mike O'Sullivan, penciled by Tim Seeley and Nelson Blake II, with colorists Greg Nervaso, Jason Millett, Art Lyon, as well as summaries written by Brian Tawney, Evan Saltz, Mike O'Sullivan. Tim, let's talk about the cover.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
And then I jump back in as Tim and I say, well, the cover for The Hunt for Cobra Commander, let's go back a second. This is a 25 cent comic, and so this acts as a bookend to the first year of G.I. Joe America's Elite, which launched with an issue zero that was 25 mm-hmm. cents. And I talked a lot about that in the episode where we talked just about issue one of America's Elite. This comic is skinnier than normal, but it's only 25 cents. Okay, so the cover is penciled by Mike O'Sullivan, which is fascinating because he is a G.I. Joe writer coming up in America's Elite after Joe Casey, as well as...
But primarily, Mike O'Sullivan is the editor for the book, so that makes it even stranger, more unusual.
Yes, yes. Okay. And this cover, which is penciled by the book's editor, is inked by Josh Medors, the book's penciler, and then colored by Rob Ruffalo, who has colored some previous issues and who I talked about had colored and drawn for Dreamwave on some Transformers books. And then the cover design is credited to Evan Salt. This is a really striking and interesting cover. It has a giant 25 cent burst in red letters on a yellow burst on the top left corner. And then it is the cover's all black, except that two-thirds of the cover is either logo or the Cobra insignia, although the Cobra insignia has a distressed texture to it. And then sort of lurking out at us from behind beneath the Cobra insignia are Cobra Commander's eyes. And so this cover is juggling two things. It is ostensibly a close-up of hooded Cobra Commander looking at you while wearing his hood in, you know, some kind of darkness, because you don't see where his head ends and the background begins. And there's a sense of sort of shadow sort of around his eyes where he's peeking out from behind these two eye slits. And in this newer Cobra Commander costume, the Cobra insignia is all over the front of Cobra Commander's hood. It's not a very, very small stamp at the forehead. But what's actually happening with this cover is there is a drawing of these eyes, and then the Cobra insignia has been sort of graphically applied in place where the actual Cobra insignia on the cloth of this hood would be sort of wrapping slightly, you know, over the forehead, around the cheekbones, on draped cloth. So it is a very striking cover. I think this logo has been squished. The Cobra insignia has been horizontally squeezed a little bit to make it fit in the narrow ratio of the comic book width, but I'm not sure. And then on the bottom, in both sort of white tech lettering and also a distressed texture, it says, "The Hunt for Cobra Commander." So all black and red cover with these two menacing blue eyes from a Caucasian mysterious guy glaring at you.
Mm. Before we got too far onto the inside and talked about the book, I thought I'd sort of just touch upon the main artist of this issue and who goes on to become the lead penciler for the next few issues of the America's Elite title, which is Josh Meadows. He doesn't have a huge amount of credits to his name, but he does have somewhat of a sad story to his life. So Josh Meadows was an American artist of mainly horror comics based in Ohio. After getting his education in graphic design and cell animation / illustrations at the Art Institute of Pittsburgh, he worked as a freelance illustrator before turning to comics. He got his big break working with writer Steve Niles, who he met virtually via Steve Niles' website, working on several of his horror comics, including Dial M for Monster, Horricide, and 30 Days of Nights. He worked on titles such as Frank Frazetta's Swamp Demon and G.I. Joe America's Elite, as well as his own Willow Creek. Meadows passed away at the age of 36 after a long battle with spinal cancer in November 2012. He had been ill since 2008 and was one of the driving forces behind the Help for Heroes charity, an organization that helps others in the comic book industry with cancer.
Yeah, I just want to point out that those projects that Meadors drew for with Steve Niles were before G.I. Joe. So the 30 Days of Night annual is 2004. The Fused miniseries is late 2003, early 2004, and others. And so, you know, when I talk about his work on G.I. Joe, I will remind myself that even though he's relatively new in comics when he gets to G.I. Joe, it is not his first professional work. And he'd already been drawing, he'd already drawn, you know, a year's worth of issues for IDW and Dark Horse.
Let's have a plot breakdown of this, the main story in this book, all six pages of it.
Plot breakdown.
On special assignment by Hawk, Spirit is trying to track down Cobra Commander and is feeding back regular updates. Spirit follows leads for Cobra Commander, aka the Blue Ghost, to an isolated cabin in Peru. On entering the shack, Spirit finds images of his family on a computer screen. and with a gun trained to Spirit from behind, Cobra Commander reveals himself. Hello, Iron Knife. You've been expected. Bork sits in the dark in his wheelchair, waiting for the next update from Spirit, which seems unlikely to arrive.
Is this where we do the jingle about action figures?
New toys!
Okay, so previously on Talking Joe, you and I and our then co-host Jay Cordray talked about Spirit Iron Knife's costume in the early Devil's Due run, the Josh Blaylock run. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was the Brandon Jurwa run where he's in all black.
Right.
And the internet is reminding me that Spirit gets a new action figure in 2005. And this is what we're looking at in this story. And it's all green with some beige boots and straps and wrist gauntlets. So, Mark, do you remember, is this the first time we've seen the 2005 green Spirit costume toy design in Devil's Due Comics?
I think it probably is. Yeah, because it sort of took a sort of slightly strange circulatory route to get to this place, because as you say, we were introduced to Spirit in a kind of black sneak suit in the comic, so that's where that kind of look originates. And then not too long after he had appeared in that suit in the comic, we got this 2005 edition of the toy inspired by that look, but in green rather than in black. And then the following year, we get a variant of that same costume paint in a black color in 2006, which was a comics three pack, which was based on the reprint of Devil's Due issue 16, which included Covergirl, Hannibal, and Spirit in the black version of the costume. So the black costume that inspired this green costume in the toy came about as a reprint of the green costume, and now a few years later we're seeing the green costume in the pages of the comic for the first time. Get all that?
Yes, I did. Mm. Should we talk about the costume?
Go for it. Yeah,
I like it. Generally, my preference is that Joe's should be two colors or three colors, with an exception for, say, Snake Eyes or Storm Shadow or the 1982 characters. You know, when I think of, say, Blowtorch, and I think, oh, fire, I don't think yellow or red, orange, pink. I think yellow and red, orange, pink, right? When I think of Spirit, I think of three colors. I think of light blue and beige and red, because those are, if you squint, that's what his original action figure is. So even though this is green with some beige accessorizing, I do wish it was, you know, green and dark green, or green top and gray pants, or something. I appreciate that if it's going to be sort of fewer colors, it's you know, simpler, and this is a pretty elegant design, but it does jump out to me for 2005, 2006 as a little too, you know, like 1982.
Right.
But, you know, I would rather a Joe be too simple than overdone.
Mm. And yeah, and it makes sense that they're using this green version of the costume from a storytelling point of view, given that he's on a jungle mission and it's more camouflaged than the black suits, which is, I guess, more suited to sneaking about at nighttime, like a shaman ninja. That's a thing.
All right. So do you have an overall reaction to this story?
So I've got probably three main thoughts to this story. One is, it's six pages. That's short, but they've got, I guess, a storytelling objective to do, and they accomplish it within those six pages. In terms of the way that it's structured, it's these sort of narrative call out boxes in black with yellow text, which is not necessarily the easiest on the eye to read, particularly in print, it's quite small. So you've got to be squinting and paying attention.
Yeah, the text is smaller than sort of standard for comics lettering.
And then the third one is probably the art, which is quite striking. So, Tim, would you like to pick up on either one of those three?
Yeah, the story structure is that each page, so the opening tag at the top of the first story page, I'm not talking about the table of contents credits page, it says, this story takes place before G.I. Joe, America's Elite Number Zero. And I remember, I thought when I read this, oh, well, that diffuses so much of the urgency, because I sort of remembered this was this sort of side but important thing that I should read before issue 13. Oh, this is a flashback? Well, it can't be that important. But then immediately I understand what the timeline is doing, because the first page refers to February. Second page is March. This is in Spirit's communique to Hawk in his narration. And then the next page is May, and the next page is July. And then the final page just continues that July message. And so even though the beginning of the story takes place before issue zero, the story takes place over a few months. And
Can I interrupt on that point, Tim? Because I think that there's probably a slight disconnect between the text boxes and those sort of communiques back to Hawk and what is going on the page in terms of the drawings. So I think the text is kind of getting us up to speed of a long hunt over the period of a few months. But the actual images that we're seeing is that final July piece after he's sent that last email back to Hawk, where he's going to investigate this, what does he call it, a small shack deep in the wilderness.
I see what you're saying, and I think you might be right, but also note on the second page that in
this destroyed village,
when he picks up the spent shell casing, he sees it, and also the narration refers to it. So I do think that if not quite literally chronologically, the narration takes place more in the past and the visuals take place sort of quote now, I do think emotionally they are both sort of rushing toward the resolution on the second to last page and the last page. And as a overall comment, I thought that this narrative device was quite effective and quite effectively done. You know, the first page doesn't pull me in as much as I want because it's not a splash. And not that comics have to start with splashes, but they often do. And it's pretty tantalizing. And I think of a lot of Marvel G.I. Joe issues where I turn the cover and I see some ad for breakfast cereal or something or like BMX bikes or Clearasil on the left side. And then right in front of me, page one is, you know, a splash with a title and the credits, and I'm immediately pulled in. You know, a large image pulls me in. That is not happening here, but they do try with a sort of half splash, that larger image of Spirit on the bottom. But there's only six pages to work with, so it's reasonable not to spend any of it on a full splash. But I think the 1-2-3 punch of, oh, what an interesting narrative device. Oh, no, he just got caught. Oh, no, I don't think he's getting out of this. Because it feels like there's a little bit more of a time jump from the second to last page to the last page with Hawk reading the message, even though, you know, the message ostensibly is like an instantaneous communique. You know, Spirit sends it and then like, later today, I'm going to go down and look inside. And then he sends it and later that day, he goes in and looks inside. Anyway.
On the sixth page, he actually looks up his calendar, Hawk, this is, and it's September. So I guess the implication is he's looking back at this previous email from July. It's now September, and he's still not heard from him.
Good observation. That calendar is not hard to see on the fourth panel of that final page, but it is a little small. Also, if you're reading this in a trade paperback, it might get pulled a little bit into the binding if you don't flatten your books when you read them. But so maybe Hawk is sort of rereading this now for the 13th time, 2 months later, wondering, when is the next message coming? Darn it, I'm worried about this guy. And then the tag at the bottom of the final page says, continued in G.I. Joe, America's Elite. So what's nice about this is that you don't have to read this between 11 and 12, or 12 and 13, or 13 and 14. I think this comes out, is this correct? This comes out the same month as 11.
Yeah.
Even though we're talking about it between 12 and 13. And the summary, the two-page summary that comes at the end of this Hunt 25-cent issue covers only the first 10 issues. I just want to reiterate how much I love 25-cent comics. I mean, assuming they're sort of regular comics or have some story, I wouldn't be interested in, you know, a 25-cent comic that is only a recap or is only profile pages. You know, if it has story and art pages, normal comics pages, I'm very excited. I do think issue zero is much more exciting than issue Hunt for Cobra Commander, because issue zero was a full...
It was an issue one by any other name, really.
Yeah, yeah.
This is being sort of positioned very much as around, I guess, 12 being somewhat of the end of one era of America's Elite, and 13 being a big new story jumping on part. There's a two-page advert for with a giant 13. All warfare is based on deception. There's a recap of what has come before in America's Elite, and there's a profile of some of the key characters in this issue, but most importantly, Cobra Commander, who is the main antagonist again as of issue 13. So it's very much to appeal to potentially lapsed or slightly disengaged readers about, look, he's coming back. It's Cobra Commander. He's going to be a really big threat, and you don't want to miss that. Let's build some excitement around that.
Yeah, I think you just said it indirectly, but it's worth saying it directly. We have not seen Cobra Commander in the first 11 issues, or is it 12 issues, well, of America's Elite. He has not been in the story.
Oh, no, yeah, at the very end of 12, he appears, doesn't he?
Yes. So Joe Casey, definitely in planning his three story arcs, or his year and a half on this book, has this in mind, that Cobra Commander... You know, something happens to him in that story before Joe Casey shows up. Joe Casey's going to set up a status quo. Cobra Commander's not around. And then you bring him in, you know, a year into the book.
Mm.
I appreciate that on the first page of this comic book, the credits page, behind all of the lettering, the words, the names, there is a... It's bright glowing yellow to look like you're looking at a computer screen, the data desk, but it is a sketchy pencil sort of vignette of Cobra Commander from the variant cover of...
Yes, the variant cover to 13.
Issue 13, right, which is also... The ad.
Yeah, they use as an ad as well, yeah.
Yeah, so Mark just referred to this two-page ad at the end of the Hunt 25-cent special. It is the last page and the inside front cover, and they've been building to this reveal of this ad for 3 months now, for three consecutive issues of America's Elite, where, what was it? We started with sort of a close-up of the Cobra flag. And yeah. I said, is this like Superman 75, Dan Jurgens cover with Superman's cape? And then you said, no, they're going to do something with this. And I said, okay, grumble. And then I don't remember if there were one more or two more, but it pulls back to show more of it and maybe also Cobra Commander. And then it pulls back now to show the banner, the flag is tied to a giant sort of graphical... It's the font is looks three-dimensional, as if it's this giant like cement one and a cement three, but it's definitely like a lettering effect. It's the character one, the character three, amidst all this rubble with a, you know, dark yellow brown sky. So some things about this story that I wish were different. One, already referred to the font size for Spirit's narration, his communiques, a little too small, and it's a little hard to read yellow on black, particularly when it's the G.I. Joe data desk sort of font, the like type font. But okay, number two, on page three of the art, those three locals in the jungle are doing laundry or eating and drinking at the river, and the grass around them is just this solid green. And this is a really good example to me of this convergence of modern computer coloring that's flashy and sort of good in a sexy way, but maybe not actually revealing of a color artist who knows how to paint, how like light behaves. They really just know Photoshop. And also that kind of coloring when it gets printed on glossy paper. Because the green here, even though there's some variation in it, it's a little lighter, it's a little darker, it just sort of looks like carpet.
Yeah, or like a manicured kind of golf course.
Yes. So some of this is Josh Medor's penciling, where at the edge of it, where it sort of touches the river, he does the tiniest bit of sort of zigzagging to show like, no, they're blades of grass. And I don't want to get bogged down in whether this is like freshly cut grass or grass like the suburban American front lawn that's been growing for 3 weeks or like jungle grass. But whatever it is, Medwards isn't making enough of a decision in drawing the grass. And then color artist Greg Narvasa isn't making enough of an active decision to create any effect. And if you're thinking of how color artist James Brown colors grass and trees in every issue of Larry Hama's continued A Real American Hero at IDW from 156 to 300, where Brown uses this this like template with like dark green with like little lighter green glowing dots in it. Like that's the kind of thing that could help here, but I really dislike that. So that's not what I want here. And part of what would solve this is if this comic wasn't printed on glossy paper, right? Which is not going to happen in 2006, right? Like Devil's Due is printing on glossy paper. So is everyone else. That's just how everyone makes comics then. But if you think back to Marvel G.I. Joe, which was on various grades of newsprint, the paper has variation and texture. And so if you print a sort of solid green on it, it ends up looking and feeling like there's some variety, even if that's down to like tiny, tiny yellow and blue dots, you know, on the paper. And it's like, okay, Tim, you've just spent 4 minutes talking about half of one panel because the grass is too flat and smooth and shiny. Yes, yes, I did. but I look at this and like that sort of takes me out of it, you know? I look at it and I think, oh, this doesn't really look or feel real for this moment, but I'm supposed to take this very seriously because Spirit is observing these three people and, you know, it's like the real jungle and, you know, the trees drawn carefully and colored carefully. Okay, so that's my sort of one coloring comment, right? The color in this story is that kind of aggressive modern computer coloring that when done well, I like. When not done well, I find really distracting. Two, I realize on the next page, this is page 1, 2, 3, 4, I realize page 4, panel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this is the close-up of Spirit's eyes and nose when he says, "What?" And then the final panel of the paper page when he's in profile and it's a close-up of his eye, nose, and mouth and he says, "Oh my God, my family." I realize, oh, Josh Medors is trying to draw like David Finch.
Mm.
That's when I realized a stylistic convergence here. David Finch came up at Top Cow, which is Mark Silvestri's part of Image Comics. And David Finch was drawing a lot like Mark Silvestri, with a little bit of Michael Turner and Jim Lee thrown in, or depending on your math, maybe a lot of Jim Lee and a lot of Mark Silvestri and just a little Michael Turner. David Finch has gone on to draw a lot of Batman, and I know a lot of people really like his stuff. He also did a year on Ultimate X-Men, surprisingly, and I actually like some of that a lot.
Avengers, Brian Michael Bendis' Avengers.
Yes, of course. Thank you. David Finch, right, when Brian Michael Bendis turns the Avengers into New Avengers, which is a real dividing line in sort of the history of Marvel Comics.
And here's a Joe connection for you, Tim. Mm. David Finch drew a piece of concept art for Skybound's pitch to Hasbro for the G.I. Joe and Transformers Energon Universe license, which has not yet been seen.
How do you know that?
I know things. I listen and read everything about this stuff. So on the Comic Book Counseling podcast, they talk a little bit about their pitch document. And
cool.
This was okay. One of the exciting facts that emerged.
Okay, so... David Finch is very popular, and I'm going to say something unpopular, which is that while he certainly draws the hell out of things, Batman, Gotham City, the Avengers, Ultron, Wolverine, I find his stuff overbaked and that his characters are sort of stone-faced and they're sort of always, he's got like two expressions. And I'm starting to see that in how Josh Medors is drawing these sort of small, intense, like top cow eyes and lots of lines on foreheads and brows. And, you know, it's kind of a stone face for Spirit saying, what? Oh my God, my family here? Like, I'm not expecting like an exaggerated cartoony, you know, like Kevin Maguire Justice League International face here. Like, I don't need Guy Gardner or like Blue Beetle to react. Oh my God, my family. So... What I'm saying sort of as an overall comment is I'm less thrilled when a young artist who's okay is what looks like to me taking a lot of cues from another artist who took a lot of cues from another artist. I feel like we're sort of two or three generations removed, and Josh Medors, talented, right, is really drawing the heck out of this story. Lots of shadows. Storytelling is good. But in the actual sort of finished polish of it, I see like comic book style, you know, like post 1999. And it's okay for G.I. Joe, but it's a little severe for me.
Yeah, it's funny, Tim. We're clearly in complete synchronicity here, because one of my main notes about the art was that I was minded very much of David Finch's art, so it's interesting that you did pick that up too. The other thought that I had is that it looks, and this is a bit difficult to fully put your finger on, but it looks like Josh Medors is just really trying hard, and he's putting in the effort here, and he's doing his best to draw the hell out of everything. So, you know, if Spirit is in the jungle, he's going to draw a shed load of leaves. And he's going to draw on the veins of those, and he's going to do a snake, and he's going to put on lots of scales on the snake, and there's going to be twisty trees, and he's going to, you know, define the knots of the trees. So it looks like he's, you know, he is putting in the effort and he's trying hard. But as you say, there is a little bit of sameness about some of the expressions and so on that is coming through, particularly because most of these pages feature multiple panels of Spirit looking intense or troubled, with potentially close-ups of his eyes. So those, while these aren't copy and paste type stats of the same expressions, there is a somewhat of a sameness between them, between that repetition.
The last little bit I'll say about this that I think I was building to is that Medors, to me, it looks like he's looking at comics. He's learning to draw. I know he went to art school, but he's learning to draw comics by looking at comics. And I want comics artists to also look at the real world, to draw from observation, right? Draw cats and dogs, go to the zoo, draw animals, draw cars, draw trees, draw your hand, draw your face. And, you know, on the final page, that top panel of Hawk, something about his eyes and his nose, you know, his head, his face looks a little out of alignment. And that final panel of him by himself, full body in the wheelchair, you know, his head is like a little too big, and his face, his like the front of his skull is a little too forward, and his torso seems, I don't know, a little too tall. And that final panel is not the exciting, sexy half or third page splash that the story begins with Spirit on page one, you know, taking a pose in the jungle and looking and looking and searching. But it is actually just as important, because this is where Joe Casey's hand reaches out from the comic book and smacks you in the face. He's not writing this special, but to me, the point of this special is to bring you back in for his final, you know, 6 months or so. And he's doing it with Josh Medors' pencil. This analogy is falling apart. But, you know, like, I believe this room graphically, because the light sourcing with these two windows with the blinds on them casting the shadows, that's a really great decision. The actual drawing of it seems rushed. I believe, Mark, when we started the Devil's Due run with issue one from 2001 with Reinstated, I said, I was back on board and I read this comic. And then we got to, you know, issue 9 or 10 or so. And at that point in the timeline, I stopped reading the book. I didn't like it. And I came back for issue 21, the Mike Zeck issue. And I didn't come back for the Brandon Jurwa run, but I did come back for the Joe Casey, Stefano Caselli, America's Elite. But as we mentioned in a very recent episode, when Caselli leaves the book, I leave the book also. But I am a sucker, dear listeners, for the 25-cent comic. Even if it's only 6 pages of story and art, and then a bunch of pages of pinups and data desk profiles and text and text and text. And I'm pretty sure I bought this when it came out, because I was now a lapsed reader, a very recently lapsed reader. And I was very much willing to let Mike O'Sullivan and Josh Medors pull me back in. So I think I bought this when it came out and read it, and I think I had all the same reactions. Well, this is a pretty good story. The costume is awfully green. I don't love the coloring here. I don't love the art here, but storytelling's pretty good, and the story is good, but it was not enough to pull me back in.
Okay. I just had one sort of final thought. So we typically sort of gloss over the day-to-desk profile entries and things a little bit, other than point, you know, maybe a little discussion that they're there and, you know, the value that that presents as a reading experience, etc. But typically they're a little bit dry. They're mostly sort of replaying back stuff that you know, G.I. Joe fans will remember from Marvel Comics and the events of the Devil's Due comics and so on. And also, obviously, file cards as well. So we don't often, you know, find out necessarily that much that's new. Hawk's day-to-desk profile entry I've found quite interesting, particularly one little turn of phrase that they used on it, sort of talking to the fact that he's been paralyzed by a bullet from Cobra Commander. And it reads, "It's become clear that his anger towards and his obsession with finding and ending Cobra Commander has become his most paralyzing handicap." And I just thought that was an interesting metaphor, that that his handicap is maybe less his physical handicap and this more mental handicap that he's got by this obsession that he has built up around Cobra Commander since becoming paralyzed.
I was struck once again with these three data desk profiles. I guess two of the three of them, how I appreciate the really purposeful, high-tech graphic design of each of these profiles. You know, it looks like the idea is that you're sitting at the rock and you're looking at the data desk, or you've got the portable, like, tablet data desk. And so it's the font you'd see, it's the sort of glowing image you'd see with the
the gray border and, you know, the blue type with the red type highlights and the little green dots and the red dots, all this stuff.
In the pages of the comics themselves, they sort of get increasingly sort of self-referential in terms of the data desk being a thing that exists in the world of G.I. Joe.
Joes refer to it to each other. And not this 25-cent issue, but all the other issues of America's Elite, the inside front cover, which, you know, reminds you who's on the team, is in this, follows this design ethos. So I like it. It's cool. With Hawk and Cobra Commander, especially, I'm just struck by how poor the cropping is, where you draw a character that needs more width, that needs more left-right space. And so you have to crop Hawk, like, at his knee and his wrist. You turn the page, and you have to crop Cobra Commander, like, slicing vertically, sort of where his elbow is. And, man, if I learned one thing from Bart Sears's Brute and Babe, How to Draw Comics and Anatomy feature in Wizard magazine, right? Recently revised and collected in two Kickstarters that Bart Sears did, now published as big How to Draw books. Don't have characters cut off at the edges of panels at joints. Don't cut them off at their wrist or their elbow or their knee or their ankle. And I sure wish that these poses were drawn with this very particular rectangle, this very narrow vertical rectangle, was drawn with that ratio more in mind. And again, I know this is a nitpick, but I think about the G.I. Joe trading cards from Impel, the 200 cards that came out in, what was it, 91? Remember the G.I. Joe trading cards?
Well, I know of them, but I wasn't able to collect them at the time because I
was
in the wrong place.
Maybe I should ship you one of my mint sealed box. Well, it's not mint. One of my sealed boxes, because KB Toys was totally liquidating those at the end, and I have a complete set in.
Sounds good.
Anyway, now that you're salivating, dear listeners, those trading cards had new art for all the Joes and Cobras on about half the cards and vehicles, and then about half the cards were covers to G.I. Joe issues and special mission issues with, like, plot summaries on the back. And that was in the big flurry of Marvel Universe trading cards and the Jim Lee X-Men cards, and the Joe sets had no chase cards. There were no holograms. But all those cards, all those characters were drawn with that very specific height to width aspect ratio in mind. And as a contrast, the Renegade Game Studios G.I. Joe deck building game that came out last year that I blogged about a lot after I went to Assembly Required, where I learned how to play the game, those cards take a lot of Shannon Gallant art from the IDW G.I. Joe issues. And a lot of characters get cropped. A lot of vehicles get cropped. And it's a very particular thing if you're drawing, you know, like a vamp. A vamp, you want to see all the wheels, you want to see its front, its back. If it's firing a missile, you want to see sort of where the missile's starting to go. If its headlights are on, you need to give a little bit of space on the side for the headlight lights to actually go. And one of the things that I don't love about those cards is how there are a lot of panels and covers pulled from IDW G.I. Joe comics where a character has been cropped into a square, not a rectangle, on the top half of those cards, and then the bottom half has all the, like, numbers and stats for actual gameplay. And every time I see one of those, I think, man, I wish they had had the budget and the time to hire an artist like Robert Atkins, who did a bunch of art, or Shannon Gallant, to draw specifically for this square, not just sort of like, oh, to draw any Joe, draw this Joe, draw that vehicle. Like, we'll make it fit. But to draw it. Anyway, so data desk profile art, don't like how it's cropped. Also, we should probably point out that Cobra Commander has so much backstory at this point. He doesn't get one page or two pages. He gets four, which is kind of awesome. Although also, I want my 25-cent comic to have comics. And then there's the two pages of plot summaries for issues 0 through 10.
Yep.
And it's called Year in Review.
Nice. So, Tim, as we wrap up this mini episode, I tried, listeners, I tried. I didn't know Tim was going to talk about the Impel trading cards for 10 minutes. So as we wrap this up, should we give it a score?
Yeah.
Yo-Yo Cola, not grape soda.
It's Yo-Joage time.
I feel like I should give it a 10 because, you know, 25 cents... If converting a value for money, this is pretty good value for money. But taking the cost of the thing aside, it's okay. It sort of helps build the tension and the expectation for the return of Cobra Commander proper in issue 13. It looks good. I think they give us good value for money in terms of the data desk profiles and, you know, the summary of the issue 0 to 10 and the extra bit on Cobra Commander, all of that. In of itself, let's give it a 7. Why not?
For me, this would be a 5, but because of the amazing cover price, I give it a 6.
Okie dokie. Cool. So that is us done with the hunt for Cobra Commander. Next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we will be continuing our look at the America's Elite era of G.I. Joe with issues 13 and 14. And who knows, we may be dropping episodes in amongst that, covering all sorts of other things. Because after all, it isn't too long until Real American Hero issue 301 comes out. So very, very excited for that. And then it'll be Duke, Cobra Commander, and then it will be more stuff besides. So that is wonderful.
I just want to say for the record, I think an hour or 6 minutes or so is a mini episode if we're often going two and a half hours.
In terms of ratio, minutes to pages.
In terms of ratio, this is a 25-cent episode of Talking Joe.
Okie dokie. So, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
Video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick-and-mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. TalkingJoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We're also on Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingJoe. So a big thanks to all our backers, Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now. But remember that...
Nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast!
Laters.